First, I want to say thanks for the words of kindness and encouragement that Marshall and I have received since his job was eliminated in May. We're doing fine, and as you might imagine, Marshall has had no trouble coming up with new adventures. I spend 5 days a week standing with people at the intersection of loss and resilience. It's a complicated place and not one where people choose to be. I work at an outpatient cancer center as a family counselor, helping people build resilience in mind, body, spirit, and relationships. Occasionally, I accompany families in the all-encompassing loss that comes with death. On a day-to-day basis, I am witness to many other kinds of loss. The list is long, but here are a few. Loss of identity, independence, bodily privacy, dreams for the future, physical strength, cognitive clarity, and a sense of predictability. Some of these losses are sudden. Some are incremental and ongoing. In my work, I look for ways to cope with loss, to build resilience, and to point toward hope when it can seem in short supply. I believe this is also important work for us to do together here as a community of faith. It matters how we tend the intersections of loss, resilience, and faith. It matters individually, and it matters as a community. To state the obvious, the main problem with resilience is that something bad has to come first, like loss. Another problem, which I hear about from my patients and their families, is that even well-intentioned loved ones can respond to loss in ways that are too simple and even hurtful. Don't worry, it will get better. Or just have a positive attitude. Or good will come of this. Those things may eventually be true, but they are small comfort in the moment. In contrast, I think the starting point in holding loss is recognizing that it's okay to be upset about it. It's okay to feel discouraged or afraid. It's even okay to rail at God, just as the psalmists do again and again. Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far away, so far from helping me? I cry by day and night and find no rest. Psalm 64 begins, hear my voice, O God, in my complaint. Psalm 69 cries, save me, O God, for the waters are up to my neck. I sink in deep mire. I am exhausted from crying, and my eyes grow dim with waiting. We are being honest about who we are when we name our pain and sorrow. There's nothing new about saying that in this room, but it is worth repeating. And it is tempting to say it's going to be okay, because that is our hope and our prayer. And yes, as Julian of Norwich declares, all will be well. But in the here and now, it's also okay to feel the loss. I see amazing examples at my job of how people work with loss. An appointment at a cancer center can elicit a multitude of feelings, from hope to uncertainty, from despair to relief. I see a lot of tears and I hear a lot of laughter. I see it as a sign of resilience when patients or their loved ones find the courage to say they are scared. Another is when they start a conversation with the stranger in the next chemotherapy chair. One of the clearest signs of resilience I get to witness is as patients and their loved ones figure out how to hold tightly to what matters and loosen their grip on what does not, especially when their circumstances change their view of what matters. This is the context out of which my ideas about loss and resilience have been most deeply shaped, along with the remarkable collaboration I experienced here while I was a temporary member of the pastoral team several years ago, during a time of what seemed like unending loss. Out of these experiences, I have a growing sense that the kind of resilience shaped within a faith community is distinctive. Research increasingly supports this notion that spirituality plays a role in fostering resilience. My favorite theory of resilience is actually a hybrid from several disciplines, as described by Loyola University researchers who provided trauma counseling in refugee camps after the 2010 earthquake in Haiti. They start with the organizational management concept of sense-making processes, or how we understand our identity and purpose in the world, sense-making. Experiencing a crisis calls into question how we have made sense of the world up to that point. Loss can create a collapse of sense-making, or what they call sense-losing, where suddenly we no longer understand our place in the world. We lose our sense of control, of predictability, of relationship to the sacred. In sense losing, we also realize that the future we have imagined and even assumed probably will not happen, such as when a longed-for pregnancy does not end in the birth of a healthy baby, or when a retirement celebration is suddenly followed by a terminal cancer diagnosis. Because of my weekday work, it's a vivid image for me to describe sense losing as a collapse of what we have counted on up to that point. How we tend sense losing is vital. The Loyola researchers say that resilient people and systems use the experience of sense losing to take a brutal audit of their worldview and create more sustainable practices for the future. Or to say it another way, sense losing offers an alternative to trying to force fit an explanation of the crisis into what we would have said before the loss. Sense losing can create space to build a new perspective on life and faith. This concept may sound counterintuitive. I suspect that most sermons on loss and resilience would have a reassuring thesis that in our loss, God is still in control, that we must turn to the things we can count on, that we are called to hold fast until the storm passes. Instead, I seem to be proposing that resilience is built when the faith community questions what we thought we knew and believed. Yes and no. Sense losing does not mean abandoning how we saw the world before the crisis. Sense losing is just one part of the conversation. There must also be sense remaking, which the Loyola researchers say is to courageously relinquish unsustainable beliefs about ourselves and the world in order to make space for transformation. Not giving up the beliefs and practices and resources that sustained us before the loss, but wrestling honestly with where they fell short. This is a picture of resilience as a flexible, ongoing process, rather than resilience as taking a strong stand no matter what comes. If this is true, that we benefit from flexibility, then what do we do with Isaiah's image from the call to worship of the strongly rooted tree that does not waver in storm or drought? I made a call to our resident city forester Aaron Swatsky-Kingsley, to learn about tree roots. I contacted him in hopes of finding some wiggle room in my mental image of tree roots as unchanging and rigid and static. And I am glad to report that I was way off base. Yes, tree roots are strong and stable, but they are far from passive. Tree roots are in a constant process of adapting to what their environment brings them. They manage energy and distribute hydration to the whole tree, and they interact with the living, breathing multiverse of soil around them. In times of drought, trees shed leaves in order to send all the energy they can deep, deep into their roots for protection. In temperate climates like ours, trees go through a cycle of loss every winter, counting on their roots to actively manage the tree's resources until the new spring arrives. Tree roots are strong and stable, and they are constantly adapting. Tree roots are sense makers. This brought to mind a childhood memory from summer trips to the Jersey Shore. A favorite beach game was to gather at least two people and plant our feet side by side into the heavy, wet sand just inside the tide's edge. The winner was the person who could stay upright the longest without moving their feet, despite the tide pulling at our feet, pulling them deeper into the sand, and competitors offering friendly shoves. Laughing and splashing at the water's edge is nothing like trying to stay upright during loss. But I think it can illustrate something about the kind of resilience I'm proposing. And so my capable assistants, Jordana and Jonah Ferran, are going to illustrate this game for us as only siblings would be able to do. Jordana will first demonstrate the easiest way to lose the game. It was to hold my body as stiff and still as possible, feet together, knees together and locked, arms crossed, posture fixed. This is rigid sense making. All right, Jonah, you have to also plant your feet. All right. All right, be nice to your sister. Everybody's watching. Okay, game on. Pretty easy. Now Jordana will show us how to do much better in the game. With a grounded but flexible posture, one that still resists loss, but with a wider base and more motion, soft knees, arms out for balance, a little like waiting for a volleyball serve. Round two, go ahead. Much better, much better. Thank you. With these images of active rootedness in mind, the question for us this morning is how we build that together as a community of faith. The research recognizes more and more that spirituality and identifying with a faith community helps to build resilience. For example, resilience is increased by having a sense of meaning that is bigger than the individual. That's a foundational element of a faith community. We believe in something larger. Something that can help to sustain us in crisis and help us to make sense of suffering. That sustaining can take a variety of forms, as we know here, from practical support like meals and children's playdates, to providing a sense of belonging during circumstances that can bring isolation and vulnerability. The faith community can also keep reminding those in the midst of loss that they are part of a long history of God's people finding ways to move forward with courage and hope. And that God's people are skilled at improvising, at taking our beliefs and resources and engaging them in novel ways to make sense of what is in front of us, to take a few loaves and fishes and feed the whole crowd. The Loyola researchers propose that resilient people possess three characteristics: a staunch acceptance of reality, a deep belief that life is meaningful, and an uncanny ability to improvise. Resilient sense-making means talking and wrestling together about our doubts, our certainties, and our hopes. In families, in small groups, in mentor-mentee pairs, and in our corporate worship. To bring this all together, I'd like to try a bit of Midrash with the Luke text that Randy read for us this morning. Midrash, as we practiced for a time last year, is looking inside and between the lines of a text. In today's gospel story, we celebrate that the woman was healed of her affliction, and we kind of celebrate, too, that the synagogue leader got rebuked. But we don't know much about this woman, nor do we know much about the synagogue leader who responded to her healing with outrage. That gives us a lot of space to look between the lines of this story, including wondering how the others in the crowd might have needed to remake sense after what they saw that day. We are told that the woman had been bent for many years. I imagine that it was difficult for her to get from place to place and to be accepted in her society, let alone welcomed. But she was present in the crowd and was offered healing. The NRSV translation uses the language of the woman being set free. Because of the synagogue leader's angry reaction, I propose that we could say that he also had an affliction of many years, that of his rigid adherence to Sabbath law. He had forgotten the reason for the Sabbath, replacing it with rules and accusations. So I wonder why the leader wasn't also offered healing. Perhaps the woman was healed because through those years of being bent, she had managed to become flexible in her sense-making, and this had created space for healing to occur. Perhaps the synagogue leader was too stuck in rigid sense-making to even see the possibility of freedom from what bound him. And isn't this exactly the stereotype of mainstream and evangelical Christian church leaders? That those with power in the church insist that we do something or understand something a certain way because it's always been done that way. That the church is the place to withstand change, not be transformed by it. But it is those very people of faith who remain static and self-preserving whom Jesus most often rebukes. Perhaps discipleship is really a continuous process of sense losing and sense remaking, to keep learning, asking, adjusting, and trying again. Perhaps like the Isaiah text read by Leah and Emerson and Eliza and Quinn, we can access resilient strength from our bones and use that to be rebuilders of ruins, restorers of neighborhoods, and healers of broken places. For people of faith, maybe resilience at its core is an expression of resurrection hope, that new life can come even after the most bewildering, sorrowful, hopeless times. Resilience is the disciples, after Jesus had died, after everything they thought they knew had collapsed, going fishing and having the flexibility to cast their nets on the other side of the boat. Resilience is claiming that the story continues in the midst of and after the loss, even when it feels like everything ceases to have meaning in the midst of the loss. Resilience is choosing to celebrate Easter. Every year has death and loss. But we choose to also name again and again that new life is part of that same story. Loss changes us. But the Spirit hovers and weeps with us in that loss, and then nudges us bit by bit not to let loss have the final word. May we find that resilience in ourselves and help to foster it in each other. Amen.